Hello and welcome, IRIS listeners. This is hour three of the Des Moines Register, and I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. This hour begins with the obituaries from the Register. Ray Cameron of Apache Junction, Arizona, formerly of Winterset, passed away on Saturday, May 15. See WintersetMadisonian.com for a full obituary. From Sheraton, Harlan Lewis Ranshaw died on June 13th at the age of 95. A celebration of life service will be held on July 3rd at 1 p.m. at the First Lutheran Church in Sheraton. For more information, please visit the website for Piersbacher Funeral Home, Sheraton. Neil Hansen of Dallas Center passed away on June 25th after 95 years while surrounded by family, preceded in death by his wife and eldest son. Neil will be remembered by all those who had the opportunity to get to know him for his laugh and gift of gab. A farmer through and through, who retired in his early 80s, Neil kept in close touch about the farm with daily calls to his youngest son, who has taken over the family farm and business. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, 7-3, July 3rd, at the Granger Catholic Beaver Cemetery. All are welcome. Lametta Wynn, former mayor of Clinton, Iowa, died on June 24th from complications of Alzheimer's disease. Lametta Karen Johnson was born on August 4, 1933, in Galena, Illinois, the youngest of nine children of Garrett Day and Mosey Lee Clark Johnson. She graduated from Galena High School and went on to graduate from St. Luke's College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with a degree in nursing. In 1955, Lametta moved to Clinton to be near her sisters, where she eventually took a job at Mercy Hospital and met and married her late husband, Thomas Wynn Sr. Her political career began in Clinton as president of the PTA at Kirkwood Elementary School in the 1960s. Later, she went on to serve on the Clinton Community School Board for 12 years, 3 years as president. When asked why she served on the school board, Lametta replied that all 10 of her children had received good educations from the Clinton school system, and that she simply wanted to give back. Lametta was very proud of the successful alternative school concept that was developed during her school board tenure, once commenting that, quote, "Students who otherwise wouldn't have succeeded or graduated from high school, many went on to college and other training, which provided for very successful lives," end quote. In 1993, Lametta ran for mayor of the city of Clinton and lost, coming in third out of five candidates. She ran again in 1995 with strong public support and won 54% of the vote against four men. In winning, Lametta cemented her place in Iowa history, becoming the first African-American woman to hold the office of mayor in any Iowa municipality. She served two subsequent terms, winning decisively. When Lametta was first elected, television crews from Germany and the Netherlands showed up for interviews. One of them said they couldn't believe that a city in a lily-white state would elect an African-American woman to be their mayor. Lametta never ran on race. She ran on the belief that she was the best person for the job, and she was always right. In 1999, as mayor of Clinton, Lametta initiated annual trips to Washington, D.C., which resulted in the Clinton area receiving more than $50 million in much-needed federal aid. In describing Lametta's leadership, one person commented that, quote, "She carries a hammer in her purse, important doors open to her, and she has the ability to bring government together," end quote. In addition to serving as mayor, three governors appointed her to commissions. Governor Tom Vilsack appointed her to Vision Iowa. She was appointed by Governor Terry Branstad to the Commission on the Status of African Americans, and Governor Chet Culver appointed her to the State Board of Education. Lametta also served as president of the Mercy Hospital Board of Directors. Lametta Wynn was predeceased by her parents, her husband Thomas, and her sisters, Grace, Ruth, and Mossy, and brothers Eugene, Robert, Glenn, and Buford. She is survived by her 10 children, Gina of Stamford, Connecticut, Mary of San Antonio, Texas, Janet, and spouse Ralph of Waterloo, Iowa, Thomas, spouse Carol of Des Moines, Iowa, Deborah, spouse Jerry of Des Moines, Iowa, Wanda, spouse Hayden of Lincoln, Nebraska, Ruth, spouse Gary of Waukon, Catherine of Clinton, Carol, spouse Jerry of Lakeland, Florida, and Linda, spouse JP of Des Moines. She is also survived by her last remaining sibling, Meredith Burke of Savannah, Illinois, as well as numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. Lametta Wynn loved and was beloved by many. She will be sadly missed by her children, who will, of course, remember her as a much-loved public servant, but will mostly remember her as just Mom. The mother who baked them birthday cakes from scratch with 7-minute frosting every year, baked them cinnamon rolls on Sundays, and who made lovely grape jelly each summer from the grapevine that still grows in her backyard. Visitation will be held at Church of the Open Door in Clinton on Friday, July 2nd from 4 to 8 p.m. and on Saturday, July 3rd from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The funeral service will immediately follow the second visitation at Church of the Open Door. Burial takes place at Springdale Cemetery after the funeral service has concluded. Lemke Funeral Homes assisted the family with arrangements. Fond memories and condolences for Lametta's family may be shared at www.lemkefuneralhomes.com obituary page. Eleanor M. Short of West Des Moines, age 95, passed away peacefully on Saturday, June 26, at Provident Village in Canton, Georgia. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. Friday, June 2nd, followed by the funeral service at 11 a.m. at Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, of which she was a charter member. Burial will be at Rest Haven Cemetery. Eleanor was born in Pella to William and Minnie Vandenberg Voss on February 19, 1926. She graduated from Pella High School with the class of 1943 and attended Central College in Pella, where she sang in the a cappella choir and played clarinet in the orchestra. Eleanor worked at the Marion County State Bank until moving to Des Moines, where she met Rollins M. Short. They were united in marriage on January 8, 1949. She worked in the Iowa House of Representatives from 1953 until 1965, when Massey Ferguson moved to Des Moines. Eleanor was the first Des Moines-based employee at Massey Ferguson and worked there as an executive secretary for 21 years, until her retirement in 1986. In retirement, Eleanor served as a precinct election official for many years, and she also volunteered at the historic Jordan House in West Des Moines. Eleanor's greatest pride were her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She and Raleigh were avid travelers and enjoyed many wonderful trips together over the years. Left to cherish her memory are sons Steve, spouse Jeannie of San Diego, California, Stan of Bar Harbor, Maine, and Scott of Des Moines. Daughter Shelley Browning, spouse Ken of Waleska, Georgia. Also her 5 grandchildren, Steve Jr., spouse Courtney, Monica Generotsky, spouse Sean, Emily Raper, spouse Cody, Lauren Neal, spouse Battle, and Michael Browning, spouse Kayla. Great-grandchildren Brody, Rustin, and Ryan Short, Jacob and Eleanor Generotsky, Zachary Raper, baby Eleanor Neal arriving this summer, and baby Browning arriving this fall. Memorial contributions may be made to Covenant Presbyterian Church. Myron Wilson Hasted, or Miney, of Urbandale, age 89, lost his short battle with cancer on June 25th at his home, surrounded by his loving family. He was born on January 28, 1932, on the family farm outside Ogden. Myron was the younger of 2 sons born to Meinhardt and Elsie Wilson Hasted. He married Janet Muller on December 21, 1958. They enjoyed 62 wonderful years together while raising 3 sons. Early in life, Miney excelled in all sports, but especially basketball. He served in the Army during the Korean War and afterwards owned and operated a variety of businesses, including a finance company, a nightclub, a beverage dispensing business, and an air purifying business. He joked on his 70th birthday that he still hadn't decided what he wanted to do for a career. His hobbies included fishing, golfing, investing, gardening, snowmobiling, polka dancing, and spending time with Janet and his family. He is survived by his wife, Janet, 3 sons, Mark, Joel, spouse Denise, and Todd, spouse Shirley. 5 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale on Wednesday, June 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. A celebration of life will be held at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Urbandale on Thursday, July 1st at 10:30 a.m. He will be interred at Glenwood Cemetery in Ogden. Memorials may be sent to Iowa Chapter of the American Parkinson Disease Association or Gloria Day Lutheran Church, Urbandale. A special thank you to Unity Point Hospice and Maggie. Online condolences may be expressed at www.caldwellparish.com. Virginia Reinhardt Pomeroy, also known as Jinner, I believe, of Sarasota, Florida. The world lost a most beloved friend, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Virginia Reinhardt Pomeroy, on Monday, June 14th. She was 91 years old and passed away peacefully at the Glen Ridge Carroll Center in Sarasota, Florida, surrounded by her 3 sons, Larry, Bill, and Jeff. Virginia, known as Jinner, was born in Fort Still, Oklahoma on March 10, 1930, and as a child moved many times and lived in various places due to her father's military army career. As a child of 11 years old, she was living at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii and witnessed the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. She attended high school in Birmingham, Michigan, and Vassar College before meeting the love of her life, Lawrence, or Larry Hitchcock Pomeroy, Jr. They were married August 18, 1951. Throughout Jinner and Larry's marriage, they were loving and devoted parents, raising 3 rather unruly boys while living and moving from the U.S. to Australia, England, and Canada, then back to the U.S. again. In addition to being a devoted wife and mother, Jinner found time and love in her heart for numerous dogs and cats, raising several litters of Labrador retrievers. She was an avid lifelong reader, loved a good crossword or Sudoku puzzle, and had a sharp, funny, and kind manner, was appreciated by all who knew her. All of those she touched knew she was truly something special, and we are blessed to have had her in our lives. She was preceded in death by her parents, M.G. Stanley and Jeanette Reinhardt, her brother, B.G. Stanley Reinhardt, Jr., and her husband, Larry. She leaves behind a rich family legacy, including her sons, Lawrence H. Pomeroy III, spouse Tracy, William R. Pomeroy, spouse Joellen, and Jeffrey S. Pomeroy, spouse Julie. Grandchildren, Hunter Pomeroy, spouse Lauren, Lindsay Pomeroy, Aaron Pomeroy, spouse Olivia, and Hannah Pomeroy. And great-grandchildren, Cy, Andalib, and Archer Pomeroy. She adored her family and cherished our gatherings. Even if we all did talk at once, she will be greatly missed. A celebration of life will be held in Sarasota, Florida, and scheduled at a later date. For those that may want to make a memorial gift, it was her wish that donations be sent to Southeastern Guide Dogs. guidedogs.org. The obituary concludes with a quote by Nira Wahid, "My mother was my first country, the first place I ever lived." That concludes today's obituaries. I'll turn to the sports section now and read the headlines from the front page there. What does NIL policy mean for Iowa? Could the state's athletic departments benefit from the lack of legislation? That's a story written by Travis Hines. Also included is players eagerly await start of NIL, and then a quote, "We always hoped it would come." And this is a story about Iowa men's basketball specifically, written by Kensington Lloyd Smith III. At the bottom of the page, Serena injured, out of Wimbledon. And this is a story from the Associated Press, written by Chad Leistikow, though. I'll start at the top of the page. What does NIL policy mean for Iowa? Nearly 2 years ago, the state of California passed legislation mandating collegiate athletes at its colleges and universities be allowed to profit from their name, image, and likeness. It was a law that ran in direct opposition to the NCAA's core identity and billion-dollar business model of amateurism. Lawmakers in other states, seeing a political opportunity and not wanting their university athletic departments to fall behind, followed suit. With such legislation passing across the country, the conventional wisdom became that some states had created something of a competitive advantage for their universities while also forcing the NCAA's hand to modernize its approach to name, image, and likeness, also known as NIL. Now, as the first state laws are set to go into effect Thursday, only one of those assumptions appears to be coming to completely fruition. The NCAA Division I Council recommended Monday that the NCAA adopt, quote, an interim policy that would suspend amateurism rules related to name, image, and likeness, end quote, that would defer to a university's prevailing state law or allow universities without state laws to create their own NIL rules for their athletes. It almost seems like states that don't have a law in place might be better off because there's a lot more flexibility there. Jack Whitfer, the Republican majority leader in the Iowa Senate and a former Iowa State football player, said, in hindsight, waiting to see how the process played out has actually put our universities in the best possible position, which is they can create their own rule. They all have complete flexibility with what they do because we didn't restrict it, and we didn't put anything in the law preventing them from making up the rule that they want or they need to in their conference. Where Iowa sits in the national landscape. Bipartisan bills were introduced the last 2 years in the Iowa legislature that would have put the state among the more than 20 to mandate collegiate athletes be allowed to profit from their NIL rights. The first bill contained a provision that would have allowed schools to require its athletes to put their NIL profits into trust funds that would not be accessible until they exhausted their eligibility. This year's version of that bill contained no such provision. Other states, though, may have inadvertently put themselves at a disadvantage by passing laws with similar language. Georgia passed a law, and that law says up to 75% of the money earned by the athlete can be put into an athlete's endorsement-sharing program, where they have to share with every other athlete, Whitfer said. Well, now that's in state law, and that's not probably what every other state is going to do, so now they're almost hamstringed by the law that they passed. Georgia's law does not mandate such a fund, but leaves it up to the discretion of each university. Even if schools don't utilize that option, the possibility, however remote, could be used against the state's schools in recruiting by programs in states without that language, either in state law or university policy. We were expecting that at some point there would be guardrails that would be developed and policy developed at the federal or state government level, Drake Athletic Director Brian Harden said. And if not from there, then certainly from the NCAA. But now it appears that those defined limits will be up to individual schools or conference offices, and that could create some interesting guardrail comparisons. The only guardrails the NCAA seems intent to keep in place during this, quote, interim period is the commitment to avoid pay-for-play and improper inducements tied to choosing to attend a particular school. So, while making money from endorsements will by itself not trigger an eligibility issue for collegiate athletes, it would if a university was providing NIL money to an athlete or if a school booster promised to recruit a deal should he or she pick that booster's school of choice. If we're going to put up guardrails or parameters within this space, David Harris, Northern Iowa Athletic Director and member of the Division I Council that made Monday's policy recommendation, said, then we need to default to the things we feel like are the most important to us as an association. The position schools now find themselves in is due not only to state legislatures boxing the NCAA in on NIL, but what appears to be an existential threat levied by the Supreme Court last week. The Alston case ruled on a narrow set of benefits for college athletes, but the decision struck at the heart of the NCAA's amateur model and may invite costly antitrust lawsuits against the organization. Against the backdrop, the NCAA had lobbied for federal legislation to give it antitrust protection and NIL uniformity, but such action does not appear close to becoming reality. Thus, creating a national rule for NIL was something that the NCAA was hesitant to do. From my perspective, what Alston really meant was that in this space, the number of things that we're going to be able to restrict and govern are probably decreasing and will continue to decrease over time, Harris said. What happens now remains to be seen as schools and athletes navigate the new landscape. We've partnered with a company called INFLCR. They do this and help student athletes get ready for it, Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta said. It's going to be brand new for everybody. We're going to learn a lot. Student athletes will learn a lot out of the gate, and the university will learn a lot. We'll adjust as we go, but it'll be here July 1, so here we go, and we'll just learn from it and always try to get better. Iowa State's policy will be extremely minimalist in terms of what you can't do as a student athlete, Faculty Athletics Representative Tim Day said. The NCAA waiver doesn't put restrictions in that space, and we're not going to make up new ones. The Cyclones policy will include restriction against pay-for-play and recruit inducement, as laid out by the NCAA guidelines, as well as prohibitions of partnerships in contradiction to NCAA rules like gambling and banned substances. There won't be, Day said, restrictions against athletes endorsing competitor brands to university partnerships in their own time. An Iowa State basketball player may not be able to ditch the school-sponsored Nike shoes during a game, but could promote Adidas or Under Armour in an Instagram post. In their time and in their space, they retain control and autonomy and self-direction over the things they want to endorse or not endorse, Day said. That's absolutely their prerogative. Iowa State, administrators or coaches, also won't be able to facilitate deals, and the athletes will need to report their NIL deals to the school. We are ready to go, Day said. We have a policy in place and a structure in place to do that. We will flesh that out more as this moves forward in terms of the specific ways we'll provide support to our student athletes. Just what other schools' policies regarding NIL will be remains something of a mystery, at least publicly. We will evolve throughout this process, Hardin said. It appears, though, that the state's athletes are ready to take advantage of the forthcoming change. University of Iowa men's basketball player Jordan Bohannon, who has been an outspoken critic of the NCAA on a range of issues, announced last week he would begin selling personalized merchandise starting Thursday. Hardin said he knew of at least one Drake student-athlete positioned to sign a deal as soon as permissible. Iowa State athletes have posted on social media their willingness to partner with brands Thursday and beyond. Where the state goes from here. In the context of the Alston decision, the NCAA's deferment to state laws and individual schools, and the absence of imminent federal legislation, it's not entirely clear how states like Iowa will proceed in this interim period. As long as Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI are working with their athletes and they're coming up with a rule that the university thinks is good and the athletes think is good, I don't think there's a real reason for us to get involved, Whitfer said. Right now, I have full trust that Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI can create rules that are fair to the athletes that are fair to both parties. Whitfer, though, did not rule out taking action. The concern, from a policymaker standpoint, is if, for example, the schools start taking advantage of the athletes, he said. Then you'd try to come in and say, that's not fair. Nate Bolton, the Iowa Senate Democrat who introduced both bipartisan bills in 2020 and 2021, said he favored more immediate action. I do think the state still has a role in protecting our college athletes and making sure we're doing all we can to protect and promote their interests, he said, and not leaving it to an outside organization to set these rules anymore. The NCAA has routinely failed to live up to its obligations to these college athletes, and I don't think we can continue to let them set their own rules. I think it is important for us to codify what will be our minimum state law requirements. Bolton, though, views state legislation as a bridge measure. Ideally, a uniform set of statutory protections from a federal law would be the exact right way to approach this, Bolton said. But until that happens, I think states have to set up minimum standards. Whitfer's stance is the State House is not the correct venue for an NIL solution. It should be done either through the NCAA process, which is happening now, or through the federal government. Because neither of those entities could act or did anything, states started to force their hands. To me, the state legislative bodies that have passed laws have kind of gotten it to where it needs to be, but to have uniformity across the country, you really need the NCAA to create a rule that works. For a little bit more local news, here's a story on the next page written by Dargan Southard about men's college basketball. Hawkeyes to play at Virginia in Big Ten ACC Challenge. The Iowa men's basketball team has its opponent set for next season's ACC/Big Ten Challenge. The Hawkeyes will play at Virginia on November 29th as part of the 2021 event. Game time and television information will be announced at a later date. Iowa and Virginia have met three previous times, but this will be their first meeting in the Big Ten ACC Challenge. The Hawkeyes won the first two meetings against the Cavaliers, 73-60 in the 1997 NCAA tournament and 75-64 in the 2013 NIT quarterfinals in Charlottesville, Virginia. The Cavaliers topped Iowa in the last meeting at the 2016 Emerald Coast Classic. Iowa finished 22-9 last season, but loses key pieces, including National Player of the Year Luke Garza and NBA draft hopeful Joe Wieskamp. Virginia finished 18-7 and won the ACC regular season title, going 13-4 in league play. The Cavaliers lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament to Ohio as a number 4 seed. Virginia is set to lose its top 3 scorers. And then back to that other headline, Serena injured out of Wimbledon. And this is from the Associated Press, written by Chris Lehuritz. I misread that name previously. My apologies. The dateline is Wimbledon, England. Serena Williams bit her upper lip. She held her left hand over her mouth and tried to hold back tears while getting ready to serve. It was the first set of her first round match Tuesday at Wimbledon, and Williams knew this day at a tournament where she has won 7 of her 23 Grand Slam singles titles was about to end because she injured her left leg when she lost her footing behind a baseline. Moments later, her legs buckled as she tried to change directions to chase a shot by her opponent, 100th-ranked Alexandra Sasnovich of Belarus. Williams dropped to her knees, her head down on the grass. She used her racket to help her stand, but only so she could limp to the net to concede. Just the second mid-match retirement at any Grand Slam tournament of her career, and first since 1998. "She's a great champion," Sasnovich said, "and it's a sad story." Roger Federer surely articulated a common sentiment when told by a reporter what happened to Williams. "Oh my God," he said, "I can't believe it." Williams was serving while leading 3-1 at center court, where the retractable roof was shut because of rain that forced the postponement of 24 matches until Wednesday, when her left shoe seemed to lose its traction while she was hitting a forehand. Williams winced and stepped gingerly between points, clearly troubled. After dropping that game, she asked to visit with a trainer and took a medical timeout. She tried to continue playing. The crowd tried to offer support and encouragement. Eventually, the 39-year-old American couldn't continue. The chair umpire climbed down to check on her, and they walked together up to the net. The score was 3-all, 15-30, when Williams stopped. Williams, who began the match with her right thigh heavily taped, raised her racket with right arm and put her left palm on her chest. Then she waved to the spectators. Officially, this goes in the books as only the second first-round Grand Slam exit of Williams' career. The other came at the 2012 French Open, where she was beaten by Virginie Rozano. Shortly after that, Williams teamed up with coach Patrick Mouratoglou and began accumulating majors to eclipse Steffi Graf's professional era record of 22 and move within one of Margaret Court's all-era mark of 24. "All the best for her," said Sasnovich, who reached the fourth round at Wimbledon in 2018 for her best Grand Slam result. Williams' departure makes a wide-open women's draw even more so, as it was defending champion Simona Halep and four-time major champ Naomi Osaka withdrew before the tournament started. And so, even as her 40th birthday approaches in September, Williams was among the top contenders. With her best in the game serve and stinging ground strokes, she had made it to the past four finals when she entered Wimbledon, winning in 2015 and 16, missing the tournament while pregnant in 2017, then finishing as the runner-up in 2018 and 2019. It was canceled last year because of the pandemic. Williams was hardly the first player to find it difficult to deal with the slick grass over the first 2 days of main draw play. In the match that preceded hers in the main stadium, eight-time Wimbledon champion Federer advanced when his opponent, Adrian Mannarino, hurt his right leg late in the fourth set when he tumbled near the same spot Williams did. Federer was trailing 2-1, but ahead 4-2 in the fourth when Mannarino fell. He tried to continue but dropped 8 of 9 points when they resumed and called it quits. Obviously, Federer acknowledged he was the better player. Novak Djokovic fell twice in the first set of his first-round victory Monday at Center Court 2. I do feel it feels a tad more slippery, maybe, under the roof. I don't know if it's just a gut feeling. You do have to move very, very carefully out there. If you push too hard in the wrong moments, you do go down, Federer said. I'll move from the sports now to the life section of the Register. The article featured on the front page there is titled House of Peace, Jewish Congregations Gather at Davenport Location. And it is written by Alma Gall. The dateline is Davenport, Iowa. The congregations of Temple Emmanuel, Davenport, and the Tri-City Jewish Center, Rock Island, are leaving their respective buildings and moving to a new single location on Davenport's East Kimberly Road to pool resources and make each stronger. The new space will be called Beit Shalom Jewish Community, meaning House of Peace. And it is being created in an existing building originally constructed as a Ryan's Family Steakhouse, and later a Mel Foster Company office. Leaders hope it will be ready by early September, in time for the Jewish High Holy Days. The Quad City Times reports the reason for the historic move is that both congregations have experienced declining membership, and more than 5 years ago, leaders of the Tri-City Center realized that their building, constructed in 1981, had become bigger than they needed and was no longer centrally located to its members. Steve Geifman, president of the new community, explained, "The center began exploring options and talking with leaders of Temple Emmanuel. Earlier this year, the two reached a sharing agreement in which they each will maintain their own identity, board of trustees, and prayer books and services, but will share space and a rabbi." Rabbi Linda Burtendahl, who will serve as rabbi to both, said, "Temple Emmanuel was founded in 1861. It is the oldest Jewish congregation in Iowa and is a Reform congregation. The Tri-City Jewish Center, founded in 1936, is a conservative or traditional congregation that in 1950 and 1968 took into its fold two Orthodox congregations founded in Rock Island in the early 1900s. The congregations expect that by pooling their resources, that they will become stronger and more vital, creating the kind of critical mass that makes worship and celebrations more meaningful," Rabbi Burtendahl said. Together, Beit Shalom will have about 180 member families, making the new 11,000-square-foot location just the right size, Geifman said. By comparison, it is about the same size as Temple Emmanuel, while the Tri-City Center is about 30,000 square feet. The Beit Shalom location at 2215 East Kimberly Road, just west of the intersection with Jersey Ridge Road, was built in 1992. When the steakhouse closed, the building was briefly occupied by Bishop's Buffet, then was purchased by Mel Foster Company as a headquarters, but has been vacant for at least 5 years. The building was purchased for $685,000 in December of 2019, according to Scott County Assessor Records, and it is being gutted and reconstructed by Russell Construction Company. About $1.4 million will go into rehabbing the 10,000-square-foot space, according to building permit records on the county assessor website. "We did it," Geifman said one recent morning, leading a construction tour of the building. "It's working. We're really excited. The front door will open to a foyer with a mosaic tree of life on the floor that will merge into trees of life on the walls, brought from both synagogues. The sanctuary will be straight ahead in the middle of the building, flanked by equal spaces that can be opened or closed as needed to form separate rooms or create a bigger sanctuary. The area, located on the northeast corner of the building, will be flooded with light from existing windows. Classrooms will be built on the south, opening to a patio. There will be a kosher-style kitchen available for events and catering, a library that can double as a small chapel, offices, and a room with video equipment so that events, meetings, or services such as funerals can be live-streamed to people who cannot attend in person. There also will be space for both congregations' memorabilia, Geifman said. Religious and historic objects will be removed from their respective homes and incorporated into the new space, including three Ner Tamids, or eternal lights, that are always lighted to symbolize God's eternal presence. Also being brought over are the oversized doors and Ten Commandments from the Rock Island Synagogue, stained glass windows from Temple Emmanuel, and the Arks of the Law, or cabinets, that enshrine the sacred Torah scrolls used for public worship, Geifman said. The building also will be home to the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities, a nonprofit organization formed in 1980 to provide social services to the Jewish community, especially senior citizens and children, and to be the voice of the Jewish community to the Quad Cities at large. One of the smallest of 155 Jewish federations in North America, it has been located in the Tri-City Center. The new location is not blessed with the park-like setting of the Tri-City Center, with its many trees and stream, but landscaping is part of the plan. And overall, the building was right-sized for both communities, Geifman said. It also has 180 parking slots, something that would be hard to find elsewhere in the middle of town, he said. Although the Beit Shalom site may not be 100% completed by September 6th through 16th, the time of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Geifman expects it to be far enough along for observance. In bringing the Jewish community together, I feel great optimism and joy, Rabbi Berthenthal said. I think it will strengthen both congregations and the community in general. Geifman agrees. While some might regard the change as downsizing, in reality, it makes us stronger, he said. Our membership is excited. It is the best thing and at the right time. At the bottom of the page is a story by Robin Opsel. Iowa Wine wins Best in Show for Sweet Rosé at Florida Competition. Iowa may not be wine country, but that didn't stop the state from producing what one competition named the best sweet rosé of the year in an international wine competition earlier this month. Soldier Creek Winery, based in Fort Dodge, walked away from the Rosé Competition 2021 with a Best of Show win for the sweet wine category for its Paragon Pink wine. A rosé blend vintage 2020, Paragon Pink can be picked up for $19 at the winery in person or shipped online. Judges said they were thrilled by its balance of fruit, sweetness, and complexity at the competition, according to a news release. And the makers note online that it has strong grape and strawberry jelly flavors. The competition was held at the Fort Lauderdale Women's Club in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on June 18th. Hosted by the American Fine Wine Competition, the Rosé exclusive event had judges test and compare more than 160 entries. Judges went into each wine tasting blind, with no information about where or when the wine was produced. That method allows underdog wines from places like Iowa or Rhode Island to shine through and even win, Judge Sonny Fraser said in the release. Wine from other unlikely places won other categories in the competition, too. Judges gave the top award in the dry rosé category to a wine from Newport Vineyard in Rhode Island. More conventional was the best sparkling wine winner, a Sangiovese Brut Rosé from Pope Valley Vineyards in Napa County, California. Judges said they were happy to see wines from different parts of the country winning this year's competition. It's great to discover new rosés coming from non-traditional winemaking states such as Rhode Island, Iowa, and Idaho, among others, Judge Michael Goldberg said in the release. Today's Life section includes the Ask Carolyn column written by Carolyn Hacks. Its headline is, Girlfriend Thinks Her Parents' Overbearing Behavior is Normal. And there is a note here that Carolyn Hacks is away and the following first appeared April 15th of 2007. Dear Carolyn, I have been dating a woman for 6 months. While we get along pretty well, we often argue about her parents. They call her at least 5 times per day. Once to wake her up instead of an alarm, once when she's on the way to work, once driving home, once when safely inside, and once when she is going to bed. My girlfriend, 31, believes this is normal. I could not disagree more. Her parents routinely stop by, let themselves in, with or without permission, to stock groceries or drop off a work uniform that my girlfriend couldn't get the stains out of. If she stays over with me, her father calls her a slut. Her parents don't like me, and my girlfriend just goes along with what they tell her, or she makes up another guy's name just to get them to back off. Could you please address this overbearing couple? Not only do they make my relationship with their daughter tough, it makes their daughter dependent on them. What would happen if they suddenly died? Signed, JF. Carolyn replies, JF, she'd oversleep and you'd need an alibi. Beyond that, I won't address this overbearing couple. My reason is in your letter, verbatim. I'll let you figure out which phrase it is so it really sticks. Hint. It starts with, my girlfriend, 31, and it ends with, believes this is normal. Without her complicity, there is no overbearing couple. There are just 2 people who leave obnoxious voicemail and whose daughter may fly in to see them once a year. Maybe. To create these monsters, though, the adult child needs to answer the phone, copy her key, surrender her uniforms, and tiptoe around parental criticism. About that criticism, a parent who calls his daughter a slut is not overbearing, he's abusive. That she still grants her abuser such extensive control over her life suggests she needs companions who stand up for her, not to her. Even then, she could use professional help to sort through this. Whether you recognize it or not, you're dangerously close to pushing for your definition of right to displace mommies and daddies. Since you and she argue often, she's not the only one getting a regular wake-up call. Your arguments are pointless. They will remain so until she recognizes and deals with the damage her parents have done. But she'll probably never do that as long as you keep forcing her to defend her family. I suspect she's heard all her life that she's wrong about this, blind about that, 2X for Y. You're just the latest to take up the cause, and you'll soon be the next person she'd rather lie to than confront. So I doubt she even hears you. It's a long shot, but she may hear someone who listens to her, who sees her, and respects her for who she is. That's someone who can build her confidence. If not enough for her to start connecting the dots on her own, then at least to seek counseling. Whether you want to be that someone, you have to decide. Either way, she has an entrenched problem she may never face. Don't make the mistake of thinking she has to just because the audience agrees she should. That does it for the Des Moines Register. I'll turn now to the USA Today and read the Moneyline stories. Home prices soar in April at fastest pace since 2005. U.S. home prices soared in April at the fastest pace since 2005 as potential buyers bid up prices on a limited supply of available properties. The S&P CareLogic Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index, released Thursday, jumped nearly 15% in April from the previous year. That is up from a 13.4% annual gain in March. All 20 cities that make up the index reported higher year-over-year price gains in April than the previous month. 5, Charlotte, Cleveland, Dallas, Denver, and Seattle, had the largest 12-month price increases on records back 30 years. GM recalling SUVs for suspension problem. General Motors is recalling more than 380,000 older SUVs in the U.S., many for a second time, to fix a suspension problem that can cause them to sway at highway speeds. The recall covers 2010 through 2016 Cadillacs SRX and 2011 and 2012 Saab 9 4x SUVs. GM once owned Saab and manufactured its vehicles. Dealers will replace the adjustable toe link with a non-adjustable one at no cost to owners, who will be notified by letter starting August 9th. Man uses boy's social security number in fraud. A man has pleaded guilty to using a boy's social security number to open credit card accounts and get loans to buy a snowmobile, motorcycle, and cars, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Hampshire said. Credit reports showed that the accounts were opened between December of 2016, when the boy was 7, and August of 2019, when he was 10, the office said Monday in a news release. The man, who is from Maine, obtained over $227,000 in money and property that he should not have received, the office said. He is scheduled to be sentenced October 7th. Also in the USA Today, here is a fact-check article that I hope I can get through. The title, Post on Dead Border Patrol Agent Misses. List uses names from more than 100 years ago, and this is written by Bayless Wagoner. At 3 a.m. on a Sunday in April of 1919, two mounted watchmen for the U.S. Border Patrol were surveying a segment of the border near El Paso, Texas, when smugglers fatally shot one of them, Clarence M. Childress, who died on April 16th of that year. His memorial on the U.S. Customs and Border Protection website says. More than a century later, however, Childress is first in a list circulating on Facebook of border agents who supposedly died during President Joe Biden's administration. The conservative-leaning political organization Secure America Now posted the list June 27th. It says the 78 names listed are of officers who, quote, passed away during the 90-plus days Vice President Kamala Harris refused to visit border communities before her June 25th visit. The post had been shared more than 1,700 times as of June 28th. In comments, people reacted with outrage. How many more will die before this radical left gets off their butts and builds that wall? This is pure insanity, one of the post's top comments read in part. I hope Biden slash Harris slash Obama are really proud of their actions. I call this treason, and they should be punished for it, along with other Democrats in Washington, wrote another. These deaths are the direct action of a very inept administration, end quote. In reality, 11 border protection officers have been killed in the line of duty since Harris and Biden took office, but their names are not on the Facebook list. Instead, the post lists the names of Border Patrol officers who died between 1919 and 2020, online records show. Founded in 2010, Secure America Now has more than 3.1 million followers on Facebook. Major donors and advisors have included Robert Mercer, a major donor to former President Donald Trump, and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. USA Today reached out to Secure America Now for comment. Since Biden's inauguration, 11 border protection officers have died in the line of duty, according to the agency's online in memoriam listing, last modified June 16th. Justin Long, a border protection spokesman, confirmed the page is regularly updated. Secure America Now did not include their names in its post, which claims to represent the period between January 20th and Harris's visit to the border on June 25th. The names of these fallen officers are Byron D. Shields, Beverly Good, Robert Mayer, Cesar Cibonga, Gennaro Guerrero, Carlos Mendoza, Crispin San Jose, Alejandro Flores Banuelos, Shane Simpkins, Freddy Vasquez, and Juan M. Urrutia. Since the first U.S. Border Patrol was formed in the early 20th century, a total of 170 officers have died in the line of duty, according to the agency. The Facebook post in question grabs names sporadically from that group. The In Memoriam page shows none of the officers on the widely shared list died recently. Some died over a century ago, and seven officers' names were listed twice, just without their middle initials. The first 20 agents listed, from Childress to Harry E. Vincent, died as officers in the U.S. Border Patrol, which existed before the formation of Customs and Border Protection. Their dates of death range from 1919 to 1930. The next 43 names are those of Border Protection agents listed in reverse chronological order. This part of the list begins with Robert Houghton, who died in 2019, and ends with James P. Epling, who died in December of 2003. Three additional names are officers who died between 2019 and 2020. In conclusion, the author rates the claim as false. We rate the claim that a list shows 78 Border Control agents who died this year as false, based on our research. The list posted by Secure America Now included past agents for Border Protection who died in the line of duty, but none of them died in the period of time between Biden's inauguration and Harris's visit to the U.S.-Mexico border on June 25th. 11 agents did die in that span, but they aren't listed. Many agents listed died in the 1900s. And now it's time to head back to the register for Dear Abby. The headline, Woman's Marital Arrangement Causes Strife for Her Family. Dear Abby, my adult daughter is married. She also has a boyfriend. Both of these men live with her and share her bed. Her children are horrified by it and want nothing to do with their mother. They are embarrassed and ashamed, as am I. Her older children are of age, but still in school. They would like to move out, but can't afford to. The youngest is a minor and afraid of the boyfriend. My daughter's husband doesn't object. Is there anything I can do? Signed, Crowded Bed in Colorado. Abby says, Dear Crowded, why is your youngest grandchild afraid of your daughter's boyfriend? If you don't know the answer, it is important you find out. If there is physical abuse or possibly grooming going on, CPS should be notified. A potential solution might be to invite your grandchildren to live with you until they are out of school and able to live on their own. A second letter says, Dear Abby, my husband's birthday is on the same day as our grandson's first communion. Our grandson's family lives out of town, about a day's drive. The problem is, my husband is not Catholic and doesn't want to go because he doesn't want to spend his birthday driving and sitting in a church. I am so torn. Should I push it? He feels I should put him before the children and grandchildren. Signed, In the Middle. Abby says, Dear In the Middle, your husband is being childish and selfish. Your grandchild will have only one first communion while you and your husband can celebrate his birthday on another day. Can you get to the site by other means of transportation to spare him the driving? He should be ashamed of himself. I hope his candle goes out before he makes a wish. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, and that number is 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And today's the day. The Midweek Shopping Cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.